flat economy is a good economy, given the current state of the world.
Seeing the glass half full for Anchorage business in 2009. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, the 29th of January. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, lawmakers want the permanent fund to dump Sudan investments that may support genocide.
And so the goal is to hit those companies that are as closely related as possible to the military effort in Sudan.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. The Alaska Giving Coalition announces Pick, Click, Give, a whole new way to reach out and help Alaskans when you apply for your PFD online. Share part of your dividend with some of your favorite Alaska nonprofits. It's a chance for all of us to come together and give a little extra. Remember, when you apply for your PFD online, just Pick, Click, Give. Information online at pickclickgive.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Giving Coalition.
Senator Lisa Murkowski has been appointed to the Senate Republican leadership team. She's one of three senators Republican leader Mitch McConnell of Kentucky has chosen as his counsel. In the position, she'll offer input and advice. It's the latest in a string of prominent roles Murkowski has secured in the Senate. Last week, she was named to the powerful Appropriations Committee, and this week she'll officially take her position as the ranking Republican on the Energy and Natural Resources Committee. Murkowski was able to rise quickly to a committee leadership role in her 6 years, thanks to the departure of other Republicans. The latest ranking member, Pete Domenici of New Mexico, retired, citing health concerns. Other Republicans higher in seniority also left the committee recently. The Energy Committee is expected to play a major role in crafting policy in the coming Congress, since President Barack Obama has cited a new energy bill as a priority. As the committee's top Republican, Murkowski is able to hire staff and drive her party's agenda. She's hired Mackay Campbell to be the committee's Republican staff director. Campbell was commissioner of the Alaska Department of Fish and Game from 2005 to 2007 and also worked in the state Senate and for former Governor Wally Hickel. Murkowski also moved some of her regular office staff over to Energy, including Chuck Kleeshelty, who's worked for Republican members of the Alaska Congressional Delegation for 18 years. A state House committee today began considering three bills that would require the state to eliminate its investments in the Darfur region of Sudan. A similar attempt failed last year without the early support of the Palin administration and the permanent fund. The governor's support arrived late in the session. However, in today's hearing, the divestment was tightened and the support was present. APRN's Dave Donaldson reports.
The Darfur region of Sudan has known conflict since a famine hit the area in the mid-80s. And the U.S. government has had sanctions against the national government there since 1997. The violence escalated early this century to the world's worst humanitarian crisis. More than 2 million people displaced, 400,000 killed. It is a genocide, and it's still going on. Anchorage Democrat Les Guerra, who sponsored one of the three bills before the House, says, quote, "We draw the line at genocide." Sponsor of one of the other bills, Anchorage Republican Bob Lynn, agrees.
The Congress has called it genocide. President Bush signed it. When President Obama was in the Congress, he voted for it. So we have basically two presidents who thought it was okay, plus the Congress, to call it genocide.
And I think every member of Congress, I think it was unanimous, and the two presidents, right?
It's bipartisan.
It's bipartisan.
That congressional action 2 years ago approved divestiture in Sudan and banned federal investment in companies that do business there. In introducing the administration's bill, Governor Palin said the investment in companies with ties to the repressive regime in Sudan is inconsistent with the moral and political values of the people of Alaska. And Revenue Commissioner Pat Galvin said the state has a moral imperative to act.
One way that we can act that has been identified and has been pursued by many other entities in many other states and the federal government as well, is to divest our funds from businesses that are doing activities that are supportive of these genocide activities.
The three bills are identical in their goals. The difference is how to go about it, and there was no argument over those differences. Because of the tight federal ban, all the forbidden investments would be in foreign companies. Guerra says there would be no investment in companies that provide military supplies to Sudan or in companies that pay royalties to the Sudanese government for oil and mineral activities. He says that money is what's paying for the genocide.
And so the goal is to hit those companies that are as closely related as possible to the military effort in Sudan, but not companies that are there to run gas stations, grocery stores, or do things in the southern part of Sudan that are beneficial to the people of Darfur.
The bill would require divestiture in all the investment funds the state manages, not in funds where investments are decided by an outside manager. It would include the retirement fund and the permanent fund. Guerra estimates that the divestiture would involve only 0.1% of the fund. Those state funds are forbidden to divest under current law. The prudent investor rule only allows managers to consider the return on the investment, not issues outside of the economic gain. Permanent Fund Executive Director Mike Burns calls that social investing, and it carries the risk of expanding the non-financial goals. He says in their specific reference to the Sudan and the congressional ban, all three bills put a tight fence around that concern. The bills will be back for public comment and a committee vote, but no date has yet been set. I'm Dave Donaldson in Juneau.
Sometimes just holding your own can be pretty good news. That was the theme yesterday as the Anchorage Economic Development Corporation presented its annual forecast for the city's business community. KSKA's Len Anderson reports.
The AEDC report agreed with other economic predictions that 2009 would witness the first time in 20 years that the total number of jobs in Anchorage would not increase. But Development Corporation President and Executive Director Bill Popp told his luncheon audience at the Denina Civic and Convention Center to think of Anchorage's job market as a positive rather than a negative.
A flat economy is a good economy, given the current state of the world. And that is what AEDC is predicting for 2009, essentially flat job growth.
As have other analysis of Anchorage's economic status done, Pop's forecast began with a description of the city's stability compared to much of the rest of the nation.
Our housing market is balanced, and it is healthy with steady prices and minimal foreclosures. Our banking industry is strong and has money to lend, and they are looking to make loans. And more people are working in Anchorage today than at any other point in our history as a city.
Last year, AEDC predicted an Anchorage job growth of 1,000. The actual 2008 number was closer to 900. AEDC's 2009 prediction is much more mixed.
200 new jobs in the trade sector, retail and wholesale, 100 new jobs in the business and professional services sector, 100 new jobs in the healthcare sector. On the downside, transportation sector will decline by 100 jobs. Leisure and hospitality sector, tourism, will decline by 200 jobs, 200 fewer jobs in construction, and no changes expected in the other sectors of the economy.
AEDC predicts overall employment in Anchorage will drop by approximately 100 jobs in 2009. The organization's estimates do not include military personnel or self-employed workers. The forecast is based in part on current employment statistics from the Alaska Department of Labor and Workforce Development, as well as interviews conducted with representatives of key industries in Anchorage. This year, AEDC added a new element to its annual forecast, an Anchorage Business Confidence Index survey. From December through mid-January, a little over 100 local businesses responded to the electronic survey. They included some of the city's largest employers, as well as a cross-section of Anchorage's economy, including smaller businesses. Pop said the overall confidence rating for 2009 was just under 52%. Anything over 50% is considered positive.
Respondents to the business confidence survey forecast, small increases in gross sales, net profits, and employment. And survey participants expect a very minor decrease in capital expenditures in 2009.
He said the confidence index also included questions about what Anchorage businesses regarded as the biggest hurdles they faced.
Energy prices and the availability of professional and technical workers are considered the two most significant barriers to growth, with 63% rating energy prices and 62% rating the availability of skilled employees as a significant or moderate barrier.
Before the luncheon, AEDC unveiled a new advertising promotion to attract prospective trained employees to Anchorage. As for what infrastructure or economic development projects the Anchorage business community thought most important for future prosperity, the first was a gas pipeline. Second was a natural gas pipeline from the North Slope to South Central Alaska. Third was workforce training, and fourth and fifth, port and airport expansion. The Anchorage Economic Development Corporation is a private nonprofit entity created in 1987 to encourage growth and diversity in the Anchorage economy. Its funding comes from municipal and state grants, contracts, and private contributions. The Economic Forecast and Confidence Index are posted on the AEDC website. This is Len Anderson.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, Barrow residents express frustration at proposed hunting restrictions.
If this is not handled right, this has a big potential for problems of major proportions.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Working late? Hear Alaska News Nightly at any time of the day on the web at www.aprn.org.
The Alaska Department of Fish and Game released the 2009 Upper Cook Inlet sockeye salmon forecast Monday. Jeff Fox, area management biologist with Fish and Game in Soldotna, says the prediction for a total run of more than 4 million fish is weak compared to the 20-year average.
Forecast to the Kenai is for a run of 2.4 million, which is about a million below what's normal. The other thing is the Kasilof forecast is also lower than it has been for a number of years. It's sitting at about 800,000 fish this year, and it's been as high as 1.6, 1.8 million. So last few years, Kasilof has been very strong, and so this is a substantial drop in that run also.
Fox says people might also notice that the forecast for the Susitna River is about twice as high as it has been. That's not because the department expects a whole lot of extra fish to head into that system, but rather because of ongoing problems that cause the drainage's sonar counter to undercount.
The counter went in the late 70s, early 80s, and we never really had any good way of verifying it. We've tried mark recapture, we've tried other counters, but in 2006, I think we got funded by the legislature, and we put in a number of weirs, and the weirs on the system, on just three or four systems, counted more than we counted with the sonar that was bound for 24 or 25 systems. So it was pretty apparent that it was undercounting by a substantial margin.
The lower than average overall forecast for the inlet could be due to a variety of factors, but Fox says one of the big reasons is high escapement numbers the last few years.
If you have 1 year of high escapement, it's not that dramatic of a decline, but if you have two or three, it's going to start impacting you. And I think that's probably has some input into it. And, you know, I'm sure global warming, more turbidity in the lakes, those kind of things are also adding to it.
Fox says the Alaska Board of Fisheries made some changes to the way the commercial fishery is managed that could help Fish and Game avoid too much escapement this year. The department expects to release a more detailed management plan sometime in mid-March. Fox expects the season opener to be in mid to late June. Barrow residents gathered this week for a meeting with representatives from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. The federal agency is on the North Slope taking comment about the changes being proposed to the Migratory Bird Subsistence Harvest Regulations for spring and summer 2009. Proposed restrictions ranging from no hunting within 1 mile of roadways to closures of subsistence hunts if the regional director deemed it necessary were presented. KBRW's Janelle Everett has the story from Barrow.
Of particular concern to the agency is the low number of Steller's eiders, most of which nest on the North Slope near Barrow. Every member of the public who spoke at the meeting opposed the regulations. The concerns range from which birds are illegal to what would trigger a hunting closure, also the consequences for incidental bird harvest, and the lack of respect shown to hunters by members of the agency's law enforcement unit. North Slope Borough Mayor Edward Itta commented on that lack of respect.
If this is not handled right, this has a big potential for problems of major proportions. Confrontational, life and death. The law enforcement wing's actions have been aggressive, and they've created a great deal of stress to the point where some people don't want to hunt, because they are feeling that they're just being harassed or being disrespected.
Last summer, two eider ducks were found dead near Barrow, which caused concern for the agency, which is tasked with protecting the species. The director of the Borough Wildlife Management Department, Takluk Hepa, told the agency representatives the ducks were probably killed out of frustration at the tactics used by Fish and Wildlife law enforcement agents.
Our people were very concerned about what happened last summer, very concerned about Steller's eiders. We are very hurt when we seen the pictures and were notified that Steller's eiders were shot and left. That's not the way our people hunt. This was not a subsistence doing. Somebody was out there who was frustrated, or somebody didn't know what they were doing. They got scared, or they left them there on purpose to make a point.
The Fish and Wildlife Service is proposing the changes in an effort to increase the number of eiders that survive each year. 81-year-old Warren Matumiak says the culprit is not humans, but other animals eating duck eggs and goslings before they can fly.
It is the seagulls. They're getting so many, and you guys protected them. And killing off the birds' nests, they eat off first the eggs, and when they hatch and they go in the water, they go around and start eating them again. And this is what I know. This is what I've seen.
Some members of the public question why hunters are not allowed to kill seagulls, foxes, and jaegers in a program similar to the state's predator wolf control program. Members of the public also asked the agency to fulfill the promise of government-to-government meetings and include local native organizations when drafting proposed changes to hunting regulations that affect their members. Larry Bell, Assistant Regional Director for the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service Office of External Affairs, says the agency hopes for better communications with the local organizations.
We probably do need to get better at talking to some of the individual tribes. That's also part of why we're also going on this trip to Wainwright Point Lay, Point Hope, to give them a chance to let us hear their concerns, which we don't always do. So I do hope they'll get better. You know, we certainly want them to be good. We want to have good relationships with them and recognize that the people on the ground are very key to the solutions.
Depending on the amount of time it takes to complete the process, the proposed changes may or may not take effect this year. Bell says because of the change in leadership at the White House, the review process has been slow. A 30-day public comment period will begin once all comments have been taken. Reporting from Barrow, I'm Janelle Everett.
A defunct bottler in Sitka has managed to hang on to its bulk water rights for another year. On Tuesday night, the Sitka Assembly extended its contract with True Alaska Bottling, or TAB, for 12 months. KCAW's Robert Woolsey reports.
When it signed its export contract in December of 2006, TAB agreed to ship at least 20 million gallons of raw water over the course of 2 years, above and beyond the needs of its regular bottling operations. The bottling plant shut down in September of 2008. As of December and the two-year deadline, the company had failed to export a single drop of water, and the city of Sitka issued a notice of breach. The Sitka Assembly appeared ready to cancel TAB's bulk water contract at its first meeting in January, but held off on the possibility that the bottler had a counteroffer. The Sawmill Cove board spent considerable energy cutting a deal over the phone with TAB principal Dick Kearns in January. Board President Grant Miller told the Assembly Tuesday night that they had found a win-win solution.
We're going to get $100,000 regardless. The other side of it is that he'll produce a buyer for bulk water. There's no real downside to it.
Miller said that TAB would agree to pay the city $118,000 up front for a one-year extension on its bulk water agreement, with $18,000 to be applied to its back lease and utility bills. TAB would cover the remaining $50,000 of its debt to the city by next December. And finally, TAB would deliver an affidavit stating it had signed a contract with an undisclosed bulk water buyer under a confidentiality agreement and submit monthly progress reports. TAB has been consistently in arrears in its lease and utility payments to the city since taking over the Sitka Beverage Corporation in bankruptcy in 2005. TAB's plant and other assets were sold off to Oregon-based Cove Partners last year. Assemblymember Reber Stein asked Miller if the Sawmill Cove board wasn't just paying out more rope to Mr. Kearns. Miller replied that it was pretty apparent to the board that Kearns had something up or he wouldn't part with $100,000. Other assembly members who earlier had supported termination of TAB's contract were amenable to the extension. Cheryl Westover, followed by Nancy Kavanaugh.
I've always been a big supporter in hoping that water will be our liquid gold and help our economic situation in Sitka. I'm going to change my mind and support you tonight and hope that you do well here in Sitka for yourself and for the Sitkans that could really use this economic benefit.
My vote was also turned around. I was not eager to do this, but I hope that I would like to see this succeed. I wish him well, and it would be good for Sitka.
The deal was the first brush with the often convoluted dealings with TAB for new Sitka Mayor Scott McAdams. He summed up his opinion in a simple formula.
This comes down to a matter of part of something is always better than all of nothing.
The Assembly voted 6-0 to extend the contract for a year, retroactive to December 8, 2008, upon receipt of $100,000. TAB's bulk water agreement allows for the export of up to 8 million gallons a day from the city's Blue Lake Reservoir. A second agreement allowing the company 1 million gallons a day for its bottling business remains in place, though the city is currently negotiating with TAB's new Oregon owners over a reversion clause in the original purchase contract for the Sawmill Cove plant. The clause, if enforced, would allow the city to recover both the water rights and the plant itself if it were no longer used for bottling. Combined, the two contracts total about a third of the commercially marketable water supply in Sitka. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Robert Woolsey.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Grant Station, now offering several webinars each month. More information at grantstation.com.
The Kodiak Walmart has had its license to sell tobacco suspended for about a month because it illegally sold tobacco to a minor. As a result, Walmart plans to implement an ID all policy statewide for all tobacco and alcohol sales. From KMXT, Jay Barrett has more.
Jennifer Spall, Walmart's public affairs officer for Alaska, said the Kodiak incident was a result of human error on the part of a cashier.
Routinely, state agencies will come in and they will test cashiers to see if they're in compliance with laws for a variety of things, whether it's video game ages, alcohol, tobacco. And in this case, that's what was going on. The cashier did ask for an ID. She improperly keyed in the wrong birth date into the system, which was the problem.
Kodiak residents and Walmart shopper Ashley McCluskey, who is not a smoker, said she witnessed tobacco products being pulled off the shelves when she was shopping on Monday morning.
I just went
to Walmart yesterday morning to pick up some dog food, and the express aisle where they sell the cigarettes and stuff, they had all the employees over there kind of congregated like they were having a meeting, and they were pulling stuff off the shelves.
Spall said employees at Walmart will be retrained in the proper handling of tobacco sales, and that the chain plans to implement a statewide policy of checking IDs for anyone who wishes to purchase tobacco products, similar to the store's policies on liquor purchases in Anchorage.
We have implemented retraining, and we will be speaking with all of the cashiers and anybody who does those types of sales on at least twice a week now until we get our license back. But on a larger scale, we have moved effective February 1st in Alaska to an ID all policy for alcohol and tobacco sales. And this is something that we have been doing in a couple of the Anchorage boroughs as part of agreements for our liquor licenses. But we just made the general decision to go across the state and do an ID all.
Spall apologized on behalf of Walmart for the incident and any inconveniences the suspension of tobacco sales may cause its customers.
We regret the error, and we are taking this matter extremely seriously, and we will be speaking to our employees from store management down to make sure that everybody understands what our policy is, and then, of course, our new policy, which is ID all.
Kodiak store will be able to resume tobacco sales on March 1st. The Kodiak Walmart does not sell alcohol.
That report was from Jay Barrett in Kodiak. The Coast Guard has assumed responsibility for the cleanup of a 158-foot derelict boat in the Seldovia Harbor. The Husky II, a World War II-era vessel, has been moored in the Seldovia Harbor for more than 5 years. Its engines aren't working, and Coast Guard spokeswoman Sarah Francis says after a recent inspection, it was determined that the boat is an imminent threat to the environment and public health and safety. In December, the Coast Guard sent a letter to the Husky II's owner asking that he develop a plan to remove the hazardous materials and encircle the vessel with boom. The owner provided a vague and incomplete plan and didn't respond to the boom request. So now Francis says the Coast Guard is assuming the cleanup responsibility.
Well, the cleanup will involve removing the diesel and water mixture that's currently on board in the fuel tank, as well as dealing with a variety of lube and hydraulic oils in the lines on board. There's also a number of drums and other containers that contain unknown substances that will have to be removed and disposed of properly.
The Coast Guard is working closely with the Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation, the City of Seldovia, and cleanup contractor Alaska Shadow. Seldovia City Manager Tim Dillon says the city tried to get the owner to take responsibility several times before going to the Coast Guard.
The owner is not a resident of Seldovia, and the last several city managers have tried. So that's why we engaged the Coast Guard in order to assist us to try and get this cleaned up between the, you know, the Coast Guard and the Department of Conservation to try and make sure things are taken care of.
Francis says more than $26,000 has been spent on cleanup efforts so far, but it's expected to cost more than $450,000 to complete. Francis says cleanup is being funded by Oil Spill Liability Trust Fund, which was established by Congress with the Oil Pollution Act of 1990. There is a possibility that the owner could end up paying some of the cleanup costs. Neither Francis nor Dillon could provide the name of the Husky II's owner. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. We had reports tonight from Jay Barrett in Kodiak, Casey Kelly in Homer, Len Anderson in Anchorage, Robert Woolsey in Sitka, and Janelle Everett in Barrow. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C., and Dave Donaldson from Juneau. Our audio engineers are Gooseberry Peter and Dave Waldron. John Prophet is our webmaster. Duncan Moon is our vice president for media production. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station. Providing statewide news coverage since 1978, we are the Alaska Public Radio Network, APRN, your source for Alaska's news.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.